Good morning. This is Tyler McFeeters with the News Gazette of Champaign-Urbana, Danville, and East Central Illinois, dated the 2nd of January 2025. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined "Sky's the Limit: Illinois Football Citrus Bowl Celebration." There's a picture of Illinois coach Brett Bielema and his team in the locker room. The next story is Urbana City Council missed deadline will cost Hotel Royer. Incentive fund will shrink by $150,000 every miss here on. This article is by Jana Wiersema, Wiersema. As the new year begins, another deadline has come and gone for the developer working to reopen the former Urbana Lincoln and Landmark Hotel as Hotel Royer. However, unlike the previous delays, this one comes with a loss of $150,000 in incentive funding. Tuesday was the latest deadline set by Urbana City officials for Icon Hospitality to achieve occupancy, which is one of the conditions the developer must meet in order to receive funding from the article does not continue. Beg pardon. Continued from A1. The city. Mayor Diane Marlin confirmed that as of Tuesday afternoon, the hotel was still not open and had not gotten its certificate of occupancy. The Urbana City Council had previously agreed to extend the occupancy date from December 31st, 2022 to August 31st, 2023, then February 29th, 2024. When aldermen voted in February to extend the deadline a third time to December 31st, 2024, they also amended the agreement to include a penalty. The development agreement called for the city to reimburse the developers up to $5.5 million in dollars for eligible expenses once the hotel is completed and received the Hilton Tapestry brand, Marlin said. The latest amendment states that this reimbursement amount will be reduced by $150,000 for every quarter past the deadline. The amendment states that the penalty is levied for any portion of each 3-month period beyond the December 31st, 2024 deadline that the project occupancy date occurs. This means that as of January 1st, the maximum reimbursement amount is now $5.35 million, Marlin said. If the hotel opens after April 1st, it will be reduced to $5.2 million, and so on. She added, the city does not own the building, nor are we in charge of the renovation. Marlin said that the city has not been given an updated opening date at this time. However, she gleaned from a recent meeting and tour that there were certain items that weren't completely finished, such as some final inspections, parts of the kitchen, and filling the swimming pool. Otherwise, it is largely done, Marlin said. What keeps me optimistic is what I've seen so far. The renovation, design, and preservation of historic public areas are elegant and sensitive to the history of the original hotel, while the updates reflect what today's travelers expect in a boutique hotel. There will be nothing like this hotel in the region, and when it opens, we will once again be making wonderful memories in a grand place that has anchored our downtown for 100 years. The hotel's website currently shows February 28th as the first available booking date. Harris Parvaiz, a partner with Icon Hospitality, said in a previous interview that Hilton's practice is to make the first available booking date later than the anticipated opening to avoid issues if the opening date is pushed back. Parvaiz could not be reached for comment for this article. He said in October that Icon wants to open the hotel as soon as possible, but not at the cost of quality. Marlin expressed a similar sentiment in an email to the News Gazette. Nobody is more anxious for this hotel renovation to be done than I. Well, except for the owners, she said. But I would rather it be done well and for the finished product to meet the expectations of the Hilton Tapestry brand and our community. Included in the article are some pictures of the outside of the hotel, captioned with, "The Hotel Royer, seen during construction in October, has yet to open its doors to guests, despite numerous extensions granted by the Urbana City Council." Those photographs were by Robin Scholes of the News Gazette. Returning to the top stories. MLK Jr. Countywide Celebration. A part in just about everything. Award to recognize Terry Townsend's tangible positive impact on CU. The article is by Luke Taylor. When news of Martin Luther King Jr.'s death came out, Unit 4 educators turned to high school student Terry Townsend to talk about how to respond. As you can imagine, they were afraid that things were going to go in the wrong direction, Townsend said. I came up with a suggestion that we, the students, and only the students, meet. Townsend didn't see himself as an activist while attending Central High, but said that Unit 4 leadership saw him as a contributor to positive race relations within the school. After he led that assembly and helped organize a march down University Avenue to the Wesley Foundation, the school district recognized him with the first MLK Jr. scholarship, which paved the way to his 2 degrees from the University of Illinois. 57 years later, the city of Champaign will recognize him with the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Outstanding Achievement Award at the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Countywide Celebration at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts at 5 p.m. January 19th. At the same event, Tracy Dace will be honored with the James R. Burgess Susan Friedberg Humanitarian Award, and Donna Tanner Harold will be honored with the Doris Hoskins Prestigious Community Service Award. Townsend's original goal was to become a professional drummer. He had been a member of the Douglas Center Drum Corps when it won a national title from the Elks Club in 1968, which he says will be the topic of his next book. But a month before his high school graduation that same year, Dr. King's death overshadowed all things. Thanks to that scholarship, and he suspects some kind words on his behalf from Unit 4 leaders to university leaders, Townsend entered the U of I the same year as Project 500. While Townsend was not included in that effort to recruit a more diverse student body, it represented a unique point in the UI's history. He was included, often at the forefront, of student advocacy efforts. There was cries for equal opportunity and opportunity to become equal, Townsend said. I had a very keen interest in all aspects of civil rights and human rights, but I was a little bit different in that I was concerned with facilities because I could see that we had a lack thereof. At the university, he became part of the push for a recreational and cultural center. Today, it's called the Bruce Nesbitt African American Cultural Center. The Douglas Center was falling into disrepair even by the time he was in high school. I was the first to jump out and begin to advocate at City Hall that the old one should be torn down and a new one should be built, Townsend said. That triggered a movement to tear down the building, and eventually it got torn down and a new one was built. Those buildings were tangible, long-lasting representations of Townsend's work and impact on the city where he was born and raised. He wasn't thinking about awards or recognition in advocating for them. He was thinking about how segregation and racial discrimination left him and his peers with nowhere to host recreational and educational events. When I see children coming out of the Douglas Recreation Center, I know I've done something that will last. It wasn't just an effort that occurred during the time, Townsend said. When I hear people speak of the Bruce Nesbitt Cultural Center, I know that I had a part in that, and I think most people would say I had a part in just about everything. Townsend served as the Champaign County Housing Commissioner for 10 years, continuing his focus on infrastructure and improving all residents' situations. He believes he's addressed nearly every public body in Champaign, whether it be about housing, employment, or other equal opportunity issues. That included working with the federal government for funding or to pressure the city government to solve issues. Townsend's work continued outside the government as well. In 2002, he helped to host an African-American all-class reunion, which brought 5,000 people to Champaign-Urbana. Not only did it reconnect these people with education, it brought dollars back into the community, Townsend said. It took years of work, including contracting an entire hotel for 3 days while the Chicago Bears were also looking for a place to stay, but it was such a success, he still has people asking about organizing another. 56 years is a long time to be involved, Townsend said. I feel good about the things that I've done, and I think right now we can look at those things and see it made Champaign a better place. Moving on to another story, national news. New Year's New Orleans Eve celebration. The headline is, "Not just an act of terrorism, this is evil. Driver plows through crowd, killing 10, injuring 30. FBI doesn't believe he acted alone." The story is by Eric Tucker, Jim Mustaine, Kevin McGill, and Jack Brook from the Associated Press. Out of New Orleans. A driver wrought carnage on New Orleans' famed French Quarter early on New Year's Day, killing 10 people as he steered around a police blockade and rammed a pickup truck into a crowd before being shot to death by police, authorities said. More than 30 people were injured as the attack around 3:15 a.m. Wednesday turned festive Bourbon Street into macabre mayhem and led to a one-day postponement of a college football playoff game that drew tens of thousands of fans to the city. The FBI is investigating the attack as an act of terrorism and said it does not believe the driver acted alone. An Islamic State group flag was found on the driver's trailer hitch, the FBI said. Guns and pipe bombs were also found in the vehicle, according to a Louisiana State Police intelligence bulletin obtained by the Associated Press. The devices, which were concealed within coolers, were wired for remote detonation, the bulletin said, and a corresponding remote control was discovered inside the vehicle. The FBI said other potential explosive devices were also located in the French Quarter. According to the intelligence bulletin, surveillance footage captured three men and a woman placing one of multiple improvised explosive devices. "This is not just an act of terrorism, this is evil," New Orleans Police Superintendent Ann Kirkpatrick said. The driver defeated safety measures that were in place to protect pedestrians, she said, and was hell-bent on creating the carnage and the damage that he did. The FBI identified the driver as Shamsuddin Jabbar, Shamsuddin Jabbar, Jabbar, age 42, a U.S. citizen and Army veteran from Texas, and said it is working to determine Jabbar's potential associations and affiliations with terrorist organizations. "We do not believe that Jabbar was solely responsible," Alethea Duncan, an assistant special agent in charge of the FBI's New Orleans field office, said at a news conference. Jabbar drove onto a sidewalk, going around a police car that was positioned to block traveler traffic and protect Bourbon Street revelers, authorities said. A barrier system designed to prevent vehicle attacks was undergoing repairs in preparation for the Super Bowl, which is being played in the city in February. Police killed Jabbar after he exited the vehicle and opened fire on responding officers, police said. Three officers returned fire. Two were shot and are in stable condition, police said. They were in addition to 33 people injured in the vehicle attack. A photo circulated among law enforcement officials showing a bearded Jabbar wearing camouflage next to the truck after he was killed. Investigators recovered a handgun and AR-style rifle after the shootout, a law enforcement official said. The official was not authorized to discuss details of the investigation publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. When I got to work this morning, it was kind of pandemonium everywhere, Derek Fleming, chief bellhop at a downtown hotel, told the Associated Press. There were a couple of bodies on the ground covered up. People were looking for bombs in garbage cans. The Sugar Bowl college football playoff quarterfinal between Georgia and Notre Dame, originally scheduled for Wednesday night at the nearby Superdome, will now be played on Thursday. University of Georgia President Jer Morehead, Jeremorehead, said a student was critically injured in the attack and is receiving medical treatment. Zion Parsons told NOLA.com that he and two friends were leaving a Bourbon Street restaurant when he heard a commotion and banging and turned his head to see a vehicle barreling onto the pavement toward them. He dodged the bullet, but it struck one of his friends. He dodged the vehicle, but it struck one of his friends, pardon. I yell her name, and I turn my head, and her leg is twisted and contorted above and around her back, and there was just blood, Parsons said. The 18-year-old said he ran after hearing gunshots shortly thereafter. As you're walking down the street, you can just look and see bodies, just bodies of people, just bleeding, broken bones, he said. I just ran until I couldn't hear nothing no more. Hours after the attack, several coroner's office vans were parked on the corner of Bourbon and Canal Streets, cordoned off by police tape, with crowds of dazed tourists standing around, some trying to navigate their luggage through a labyrinth of blockades. We looked out our front door and saw caution tape and dead silence, and it's eerie, said Tessa Cundiff, an Indiana native who moved to the French Quarter a few years ago. This is not what we fell in love with. It's sad. Elsewhere, life went on as normal in the city, known to some for a motto that translates to "let the good times roll." Close to where the truck came to rest, some people were talking about the attack while others dressed in Georgia gear talking football. At a cafe a block away, people crowded in for breakfast as upbeat pop music played. Two blocks away, people drank at a bar, seemingly as if nothing happened. We recognize that there are tourists around us, and we urge all to avoid the French Quarter, as this is an active investigation, Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry said. We understand the concerns of the community and want to reassure everyone that the safety of the French Quarter and the city of New Orleans remains our top priority. President Joe Biden, speaking to reporters in Delaware, said he felt anger and frustration over the attack, but would refrain from further comment until more is known. My heart goes out to the victims and their families who are simply trying to celebrate the holiday, Biden said in a statement. There is no justification for violence of any kind, and we will not tolerate any attack on any of our nation's communities. The attack is the latest example of a vehicle being used as a weapon to carry out mass violence, a trend that has alarmed law enforcement officials and that can be difficult to protect against. We have another story out of Florida. Hundreds apply for restitution for abuse suffered at reform schools. Article by Kate Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, for the Associated Press, and Report for America. Hundreds of people who say they suffered physical or sexual abuse at two state-run reform schools in Florida are in line to receive tens of thousands of dollars in restitution from the state after Florida lawmakers formally apologized for the horrors they endured as children more than 50 years ago. At its peak in the Jim Crow 1960s, 500 boys were housed at what is now known as the Dozier School for Boys, most of them for minor offenses such as petty theft, truancy, or running away from home. Orphaned and abandoned children were also sent to the school, which was open for more than a century. In recent years, hundreds of men have come forward to recount brutal beatings, sexual assaults, deaths, and disappearances at the notorious school in the panhandle town of Marianna. Nearly 100 boys died between 1900 and 1973 at Dozier, some of them from gunshot wounds or blunt force trauma. Some of the bodies were shipped back home. Others were buried in unmarked graves researchers only recently uncovered. Ahead of a December 31st deadline, the state of Florida received more than 800 applications for restitution from people held at the Dozier School and its sister school in Okeechobee, Florida, attesting to the mental, physical, and sexual abuse they endured at the hands of school personnel. Last year, state lawmakers allocated $20 million to be equally divided among the school's surviving victims. Bryant Middleton was among those who spoke publicly in 2017 when lawmakers formally acknowledged the abuse. Middleton recalled being beaten six times for infractions that included eating blackberries off a fence and mispronouncing a teacher's name after being sent to Dozier between 1959 and 1961. "I've seen a lot in my lifetime, a lot of brutality, a lot of horror, a lot of death," said Middleton, who served more than 20 years in the Army, including combat in Vietnam. "I would rather be sent back into the jungles of Vietnam than to spend one single day at the Florida School for Boys." Allegations of abuse have hung over the Dozier School since soon after it opened in 1900, with the reports of children being chained to the walls in irons. A story out of Montenegro. Man kills at least 10, including two children, in shooting rampage. By Predrag Milic. Predrag Milic. From the Associated Press. Out of Podgorica, Montenegro. At least 10 people, including two children, were killed and four others were wounded in a shooting on Wednesday that followed a bar brawl in a western Montenegrin city, officials said. The shooter was on the run. Police identified the attacker as 45-year-old Ako Martinovic. He killed the owner of a bar in the city of Cetinje, Cetinje. The bar's owner, children, and his own family members, said Interior Minister Danilo Saranovic at a news conference. "At this moment, we are focused on arresting him," said Saranovic. Police dispatched special troops to search for the attacker in Cetinje, located some 18 miles northwest of the capital, Podgorica. A statement said the man fled the scene armed after opening fire at the bar. President Jakov Milutovic said he was shocked and stunned by the tragedy. "Instead of holiday joy, we have been gripped by sadness over the loss of innocent lives," Milutovic said on the social media platform X. Prime Minister Miljko Spajic, Miljko Spajic, went to the hospital where the wounded were being treated and announced 3 days of mourning. "This is a terrible tragedy that has affected us all," said Spajic. "All police teams are out." Small Montenegro, which has some 620,000 people, is known for gun culture, and many people traditionally have weapons. Wednesday's shooting was the second shooting rampage over the past 3 years in Cetinje, Montenegro's historic capital. An attacker also killed 10 people, including two children, in August 2022, before he was shot and killed by a passerby in Sitinje. The RTCG report, which published Marcinovich's photo on its website, said he was known for erratic behavior and had been detained in the past for illegal possession of weapons. The report said he went home to get his gun and came back to the bar, where he opened fire and killed and wounded several people. He then went to another site where he killed the bar's owners, children, and a woman, the report added. Police appealed to the residents to remain calm and stay indoors, ruling out a clash between criminal gangs. This next story is South Korea plane crash. Investigators extract black box data, by Hyungjin Kim, Hyungjin Kim. This is Associated Press out of Seoul, South Korea. Grieving relatives of the victims of the South Korea plane crash gathered at the site to pay respects to their loved ones on New Year's Day, as officials said they've extracted data from one of the retrieved black boxes to find the exact cause of the crash. All but two of the 181 passengers and crew on board the Boeing 737-800 operated by Jeju Air died when it crashed at Muan International Airport in southern South Korea on Sunday. Video showed the aircraft without its landing gear deployed, landing on its belly at high speed, and then skidding off the end of a runway into a concrete fence and bursting into flames. The footage showed the plane was experiencing an apparent engine problem in addition to the landing gear malfunction. Investigators say the pilot received a warning from air traffic controllers of possible bird strikes, and the plane issued a distress signal before the crash. The Transport Ministry said in a statement Wednesday that it has completed works to extract data from the cockpit voice recorder, one of the two black boxes recovered from the wreckage. It said the data would be converted into audio files. A damaged flight data recorder will be sent to the United States for an analysis, the ministry added. All of the victims were South Korean, except for two Thai nationals, with many returning from Bangkok after Christmas holidays. The bereaved families visited the site on Wednesday for the first time since the crash for an emotional memorial service. They were bused to the site, where they took turns laying white flowers. Many knelt and bowed deeply before a memorial table laid with food, including jjokguk, a Korean rice cake soup eaten on New Year's Day. The Transport Ministry said officials have completed the complicated process of identifying all 179 victims. It said the government has so far handed over 11 bodies to relatives. The country is observing 7 days of national mourning following the deadliest disaster in South Korea's aviation history in decades. The government has begun safety inspections of all 101 Boeing 737-800s operated by the country's domestic airlines. On Tuesday, a team of U.S. investigators, including representatives from Boeing, examined the crash site. Officials have said they will consider whether the airport's localizer, a set of antennas housed in a concrete fence at the end of the runway designed to guide aircraft during landings, should have been constructed with lighter materials that would break more easily upon contact.